Welcome to Health Media Now with award-winning author and host Denise Messenger for a lifetime of health empowerment. Live by being in the pink, meaning P stands for being persistent, I stands for using your intuition, N stands for networking, and K stands for obtaining knowledge. Our guests entertain and share cutting-edge information. They share with you what may have taken years to achieve through experience in their field. Become inspired and motivated. Reach your full potential with fascinating tips and products. Receive a lifetime of benefits from authors, doctors, practitioners, healthcare providers, and learn about exciting new products. You asked for it, and we deliver. Now, here's your host, Denise Messenger.
Welcome, everyone. I'm so glad you're tuning in today, which is September 19th, 2018. Yes, we're almost drawing to a close of the year. I don't know where it went, but we've done an awful lot of great work this year. And our guest today, I'm so honored that he's taken time out of his writing schedule to come onto our show. We're going to be talking with John David Mann, and his biography is pretty amazing. You know, when he was 17, he started their own high school in New Jersey, and then he was also the recipient of the BMI Award for Student Composers, because that was a real passion of his, was musical compositions. He's had such a diverse career that I believe that it has enriched his life, and in turn, he's enriching ours. He now writes full-time, and we're going to be talking today about his book called The Recipe, which he co-authored with Charles M. Carroll, who's a chef. And it's a fascinating read, which I did, and I want him to share with you where the idea came from and why this particular subject matter that he chose to write about. So let's bring him onto our show now. Hello, John David Mann.
Hello, Denise. It's so great to be here. Thank you.
Is there anything else in your background that you would like to discuss with our listeners before we proceed on about your latest book, The Recipe?
You know, sure. I'll say something there, which was at one point in my life, and this is when I was, oh, I guess 19 or so, I played the cello. That was my instrument. And my dad was a conductor. My mom was a pianist. I come from a musical family. So classical music was kind of my environment, my cocoon growing up. And it was my first love. And it's still one of my great loves in my life. And I was playing cello professionally. And I remember the experience sitting in the chair with my cello playing and to an audience of, I don't know, 400 or 500, 800 people, 1,000, whatever it was, not huge audience, but playing and suddenly feeling like this is not enough. Like there were people out there that I was looking at who were enjoying the music. I knew they were enjoying it. I knew it was a good thing. I knew it was a beautiful thing. But there were too many unhappy people. And I had this I was struck with this sense of conviction that I needed to do something more to have an impact on more people's health and general state of happiness and well-being. And I don't want to, you know, make myself sound like a saint. It wasn't like some feeling of I had this noble obligation. It was like, this wasn't satisfying for me just to play beautiful music. I felt like I needed to get my fingers in the larger situation. And so that's really, I think, what began I was going to be a concert cellist. That was my deal up at that point. But that's, I think, where I started to really pursue looking at this sort of the state of human beings generally and kind of exploring ways to have an impact on that.
How old were you at that time?
I was probably 19, 20, and I got very involved then in nutrition and natural health, and that was my pursuit for many years at that point.
Okay. Interesting, isn't it? Well, you know, when we're young, I think that's the opportune time to explore the world.
I must still be young because I'm still figuring it out.
All right. Well, then it's a good beginning anyway.
Yes. Good time to start. You got it. I appreciate that. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So when did the writing start?
You know, I kind of backed into it. There wasn't a moment where I sat down and said, you know, I think I want to do this. Actually, that isn't entirely true. There was a moment where I said I wanted to write screenplays. That was a plan at one point, to become a Hollywood screenwriter. But over the years, I said I was involved in health. And in that world, I kept finding myself sort of being the guy that edited other people's articles. I did a lot of editing. For a decade or more, I made my living as an editor. I was editing articles in health, and then that migrated to business. I was editing articles in entrepreneurship and leadership and business. I gotten very involved in the network marketing world. But as a journalist, writing about that field and about what creates success in that field and what doesn't and so forth. And I was doing a lot of writing that was improving other people's stuff. And then I eventually found myself in partnerships with authors writing books. And honestly, Denise, that's been my career at this point. Still is. It's like I've published over 24 books, but every single one of them but one, almost every one of them has been a partnership with somebody else, where I've done the lion's share of writing, but I'm teaming with somebody else, which is the case with this book and with The Go-Giver, with my Navy SEAL books, with my memoirs, with all of them.
Ah. So how did the recipe come about?
You know, the book that really, I like to say that Bob Berg ruined my career. Bob Berg is my good friend and my co-author of The Go-Giver. And what happened was, I was on my way to Hollywood. That was my plan. I was going to be a screenwriter. And Bob asked me if I would help him write this book. He had this idea for a book, and I'd edited some articles of his. And he said, you know, I want to write this book, but this is not the kind of book I write. This is not a how-to or a sales book or a leadership book. It's like a story. You got to write it. So we teamed up, and we wrote this book, which became The Go-Giver. And The Go-Giver took off, you know, sort of like a rocket ship, or at least a pretty well-powered jet plane. And that book pretty much launched my career. It's 10 years later now, and it's still going strong. We've got a number of other Go-Giver books in the set. And so The Go-Giver was getting out in the world, and this chef running one of the country's biggest country clubs in Houston, Texas. This is the club where George and Barbara Bush used to hang out. So very, you know, high society, hoity-toity kind of country club in Texas. And Charles is this amazing guy who runs his kitchen staff of, you know, it's close to 100 people, like 75, 80 people. And
wow.
He runs it almost like a dojo. Like, it's really, for him, it's like a leadership school. I mean, yes, they churn out, you know, thousands of meals every week, but he really runs it. He's got a thing about leadership. He really runs this place in a very, very inspiring way, bringing up young people. And he read The Go-Giver, and he contacted me and said, I'd love to have you come out to the club and talk about The Go-Giver. And I got to tell you, Denise, I have no background as a professional chef, but I've been eating food my whole life. I love food. I mean, you've probably been eating food your whole life, too. One of the things that my wife and I love to do is eat, and we also love to cook together. So I have this love of great food. And when I heard that there was this incredible, award-winning, internationally known chef who wanted me to come talk at his country club, I was like, oh, yeah, I'm in. That's cool. So I flew over to Houston, gave a talk in The Go-Giver. And while I was there, he said, I have this idea for a book. Okay, this is a sentence I've heard said hundreds of times, and usually it doesn't go anywhere.
Sure.
I had this idea for a book, and it was like Bob Berg all over again. He had this idea for a story about a young boy who's just lost his father and whose life is at a crossroads. He's kind of spiraling down the drain and getting in trouble at school, losing his grip on life, and broken up with grief and angry at the world. And that he crosses paths with this crusty old diner chef, very loosely based on events in Charles's life. Charles is not the kid in the book, and he's not the chef in the book. He's kind of a combination of the two of them. But the story was his invention, And he said, I'd love to write it with you. It took us 8 years before we both had a break in our schedule where we could sit down and start to talk about it. But that's, I was immediately captivated by this idea, and I knew I just had to write that book, and so we did.
Gee, 8 years. Wow.
Yeah, it didn't take 8 years to write, mind you. It took 8 years to
find
a place where we could write. Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and then we finally did, and we just published it, you know, not long ago. So it's a long time coming.
And there really are some great recipes in it. I like
it's
the way
funny. It's true.
You know, it tells
yeah.
a story, and then it has great recipes as well. It's really, really entertaining.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. And it's true. There are, I mean, we think everybody loves food. And Charles, I've cooked now with Charles a bunch in his kitchen. He's an amazing cook. We the point of the book is the story. It's the journey the boy goes on. And, the, you know, the subtitle of the book is, it's called The Recipe. The subtitle is A Story of Loss, Love, and the Ingredients of Greatness. And that's the purpose of the
mm-hmm.
book, is to talk about loss. We've all experienced some kind of real meaningful loss in our lives, whether it was losing a parent or a spouse or a child or a friend or a sibling, or just, you know, we tore our knee in college and couldn't pursue that football career, or a friend betrayed us,
mm-hmm.
or we lost a business, or we lost a child, whatever. Everybody has experienced some kind of wrenching loss. And we wanted to show the journey of taking some kind of hardship like that and discovering, in this case, in a diner kitchen, but cooking is like a metaphor. It could be in karate, like the Karate Kid. It could be in martial arts.
Mm-hmm.
It could be in carpentry. It could be in painting. It could be in business. We use the example of cooking. It's this journey of finding the elements of greatness that you can glom onto and carve out really a beautiful life for yourself from a place of adversity. But there are also recipes in the book. Yes, you're right. In the back of the book, there's a whole set of recipes for dishes that we encounter in the book. And I hope that readers will have fun trying out those recipes in their kitchens.
Oh, absolutely. I know I will be. just super. What was the Go-Giver about?
The idea of the Go-Giver was, of course, it's a play on the term go-getter. And the sort of the theme of the book, it's a parable. And so it's a story that aims to teach a lesson. That's what a parable is.
Sure.
And I have a lot to say about parables because there's so many parables have been written since, you know, Who Moved My Cheese and The Richest Man in Babylon and The One-Minute Manager and The Alchemist. And there have been a handful of really huge, amazing parables that have sort of created the field. But there are a lot of parables that aren't that interesting. And for me, the key is to a parable is it can't just be a thinly disguised lecture. You know, for a parable to work, yeah, you're teaching a point. And the point is the point. The lesson is the point, perhaps. But the story has to be real. The characters have to be real. You have to laugh and cry and be wrenched and be pulled and feel
mm-hmm.
triumph. And it's got to be a viable story because people learn through story. That's really the only way I think people genuinely learn is through compelling stories. So the idea of the Go-Giver is that when you take your focus off of yourself and put it on other people, in the sense of how can I add value to your life? What can I do today to make your life better? As opposed to
mm-hmm.
what can I do to life today to make my life better, right? That when you put your focus on other people's interests, it's not just noble and nice and like a, quote, good way to be. It's also fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
It's satisfying and it's effective. It's a way to be successful financially. It's the way to be successful socially. It's the way to live a successful life and not just a noble, good life. This whole idea, what we wanted to do with the Go-Giver was show that this whole idea that it's a trade-off, that either you're out for yourself or you're out for others. It's one or the other. That either you're a
mm-hmm.
nice person who is penniless your whole life or you're a successful person who is out for number one. We wanted to bust those damaging myths and say, no, no, no. The real path we're talking about is being gregarious, interested in others, out for other people's interests, in such a way that, in fact, it does also build your own success. So that's the – and, you know, it's funny because the book came out at the beginning of 2008, and months later we were spiraling into the worst financial crisis of our lifetime. And
that's over, right.
Over 2009, you know, suddenly people were losing their homes, losing their 401ks, losing their savings. Everything's going underwater. And we thought, oh, well, this book with its, you know, its principle of look out for other people and be generous and so forth is going to struggle. No, the opposite. It took off. It was like people became more interested, I think, in looking at their core values. And the book has just consistently done better every year since it came out. It didn't come out like a blockbuster hit. It hit the bestseller lists, but it wasn't, you know, gigantic. But it's one of those books that's grown and grown and grown and is more popular today than it was, you know, when it came out. So we're really grateful for that. It struck a chord with people.
That's really interesting. I was having dinner with some friends last night, and interesting enough, the topic of conversation was helping others.
You know, I think it's idea that helping others, everybody wants to, I believe, everybody in some place in themselves wants to be that person who made a difference. I have a psychiatrist friend. Actually, he calls himself a recovering psychiatrist. He used to be a psychiatrist, and now he works professionally as an executive coach. He helps people in sort of high corporate positions to clarify their values and live congruous lives and so forth. But Dave says that the greatest human need, that yes, there's food and reproduction and shelter and so forth, but that the deepest, strongest, greatest human need is the need to feel like we made a difference. Like, to put it simply, the need to feel that you matter, that the world is a different place and a better place because you're here. And I believe that everybody wants that. The problem is we've been taught this, what I call this treacherous dichotomy, that it's an either or, that if you look out for other people, then you're being sacrificial and you're being a martyr, and that you're going to, you know, this, if you give, if you live a giving life, if you're a generous spirited person, you're going to get taken advantage of. You're going to end up with the short end of the stick. It's a dog eat dog world. We don't believe that. That's true. And we're not saying to give naively or to be generous naively. And we're not saying you should give your stuff away for free if you're in business. That's not the meaning of the go-giver. The meaning of the go-giver is when you live your life and execute your business even from the perspective of how can I add more value to other people, what you do is you make yourself more valuable. You make yourself a more valuable presence in the world. And you know, if you do that intelligently and strategically, then financially, you make out well because people want to buy what you are, what you have. They want the service you offer. You become valuable to the world because you're adding value. It's the same thing in a marriage. You become valuable to your family because you're adding value to it. So the Go-Giver book itself has what we call the five laws of stratospheric success. And the man in the story, Joe, who's having a crisis in business, he kind of goes through the process of learning these five laws from various mentors and people that he encounters in the course of the story. And he ends up, you know, despite himself, having a really successful twist of events toward the end. I can't tell you the end because, you know, that would be a surprise.
That's right. No, you can't.
That's right.
Well, let's get back.
And, you know, the recipe is the same book.
Yeah. I was going to say, let's get back to talking about the recipe. You know, in the book, the chef character, he makes this comment. I believe it was like, everything that you cook reveals everything that you are.
That's exactly it, yeah.
What is that?
You know, it's great because the boy has cooked a dish that he did in the morning for breakfast, for the breakfast rush, that he thinks he did a pretty good job. He cooked this over easy. He thinks he was pretty hot stuff. And the chef takes the plate and puts it up to the back of the counter and doesn't serve it. And he later tells him that if you're angry, if you cook angry, then your plate's going to be angry. The person who eats it is going to be angry. Mm. Everything you cook reveals everything you are. What that means is that when you produce something in the world, whether it's cooking or whether it's writing or whether it's service, like you're in retail, you're at the register, whatever it is, whatever you're putting out into the world, you're putting a piece of yourself in it. It carries the vibration, if you will, of yourself in it. And that people, whether they're conscious of it, consciously aware of it or not, people pick up on it. When you offer the world anything, a product, a service, an artistic creation, a project, what you're really offering them is a little piece of yourself that's wrapped in that particular wrapping. And so, you know, the real idea of it is there, and this is something that, you know, artists, this has been a particularly big theme in Zen and the Zen-related arts, but it's in every art. And every great artist and every even not-so-great artist knows this. Every actor, every dancer, every musician, et cetera. I'll go so far as to say every entrepreneur also knows this, that ultimately who you are is going to get transmitted through what you do. So you need to pay attention to who you are and how you're feeling. It's like you cannot fake it. You can think you fake it, and you can fool some of the people some of the time. But ultimately, if you're upset, then it's going to come across. Your motivations, your intentions, and your state of mind, they really do come across. People buy you. They don't just buy your widget.
Excellent. Very well said.
Yeah,
well,
a related
there was
expression
another
that he brings
that...
up. Go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. I think you're going to talk about how to pay attention to the little things. Is that what you're going to talk about?
Yes. Yeah, well, so many of the principles feed into each other. But the chef, who was this crusty old guy? The chef at one point says, he cites this Buddhist expression, which is how you do anything, or is how you do everything. The boy is asking if it really matters. You know, the attention he pays to cleaning up his counter, and the attention he pays to where he places the salt and the oil and the pepper and the this and that. And the chef basically says, the details matter, because he doesn't use these words, but the smallest detail is going to reflect in everything else that you do. So there's a wonderful book out which came from a commencement talk that it's Admiral William McRaven did. William McRaven is currently a retired Navy admiral, and he was a captain at the time. My Navy SEAL buddy, Brandon Webb, whom I've written books with, when Brandon graduated from sniper school, McRaven was the guy who signed his certificate. So Brandon had this great connection going back a long way. McRaven gave this commencement speech some years ago, and it was on 10 ways to change the world. And the very first way of the 10 was, he said, if you want to change the world, make your bed. And he talks all about how the way that you make your bed, the way that you start your day, the way that you configure your environment, the way that you take care of your personal space has an enormous impact on the impact you have on the world. It's since become a best-selling book, and I wouldn't be surprised if he runs for president someday and that's his platform. But anyway, that's
what
the chef is saying. He's saying how you do anything, even something insignificant and seemingly small, like how you wipe the counter of your kitchen as you're cooking, how you keep your knife clean, how you chop your vegetables, how you make your bed, how you greet someone on the phone when they walk into your store, how you greet your wife or your husband, your spouse when you get up in the morning, what you say when you're just about to leave the house, how you treat your pet, how you treat your child, how you do anything has a huge impact on how you do everything. And so, in a sense, you could take the smallest detail in your life, and by working on that, you can hugely improve yourself as a person. The way that I know this as a writer is that every time I start to write a book, I sit down to write a book, I get so overwhelmed that I almost get paralyzed. I mean, and this doesn't just happen once, but day after day after day, I sit in my chair and I go, oh, my God, I got this book to write. I have no idea what I'm doing, and I think I can't possibly do it. I have to take myself by the hand and say, Johnny, you know you can't write a book. Actually, nobody can write a book. It's too big. What you can do is you can write a good sentence. And I have to like blot out from my mind the enormity of this book ahead of me, this mountain that I'm hoping to climb, and say, okay, I'm going to discipline myself to just write a good sentence, make it the best sentence it can be, and focus on that sentence. And then maybe I'll write a few more, and maybe by the end of the morning I'll get half a page filled with some stuff, most of which is bad, but a little bit of which is good.
Mm-hmm.
How I do that sentence is going to be how the whole book turns out. So that's really what we're saying. You can hugely change the course of your whole life by paying attention to the tiniest angle of the rudder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pay attention to the smallest details.
He even says, when you pay attention to the little things, the big things will tend to take care of themselves. And I acknowledge that there are times in your life where you suddenly are faced with a huge decision. There are crossroads that you have to take, choices that you need to make. That does happen. But really, mostly I think, our lives are built out of tiny things, the tiniest steps. And if we take care of those, how we conduct ourselves in those tiny steps, then by and large, I think those big things will actually take care of themselves. Once you get to the big decision, it's almost already made because of how you've lived your life.
Well, I think intention is an important part, too.
Oh, intention is one of my favorite words. It comes from roots that mean literally the stringing of a bow. It's like an intention is you're stretching a string out to either pluck a note or shoot an arrow. And I think that there's that stretched string of your intention, I think, is enormously, enormously powerful. I think it's mm-hmm. something that you know, you and I almost can't emphasize too much.
Mm-mm. And I think excellence also. You know, it's one yeah. thing to tackle a task or tackle a project, but you have to have the desire to want to achieve excellence in what you're doing.
Yeah. You know, people have asked me many times, how did you end up writing a book with a country club chef? How did you end up writing books with a Navy SEAL sniper? Because I will tell you, Denise, I am not a Navy SEAL sniper. I have never
Jeez.
Been in the military.
Navy SEAL sniper.
I mean,
I'm
a cellist. You know, I mean, you couldn't have a different background. And by the way, I'll just put this in as a footnote. The principal role of snipers isn't to shoot people. The principal role of snipers is to do reconnaissance and intelligence. So, you know, what it actually looks like to be in the field as a sniper is largely it's like you're an intelligence gathering instrument. But I'm getting off on the side. My point is, people have asked me, how on earth did you and Brandon, we've written 5 books together now, my ex-SEAL friend and I, how on earth
wow.
did you click so well and write all these books?
Mm-hmm.
And the first few were memoirs, were military memoirs, but our most recent book is called Mastering Fear, and the one before that is Total Focus. And they're books about, you know, anybody in their ordinary civilian business life or whatever. They're not military books, but what one thing that Brandon and I clicked on, it's the same thing Bob Berg and I clicked on, it's the same thing Chef Charles Carroll and I clicked on, is exactly what you just said. We've all got this thing for excellence. We whatever it is that we're doing, we really seem to have this sort of almost inbred genetic passion for just doing it as well as we possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that we really click on, and it's something that I really pursue in every book that I write. I think it's so – I agree with you. I think it's so important. It's not – and excellence doesn't mean you have to be the best in the world. It doesn't mean you have to be super talented. It doesn't mean you have to be an amazing person.
Mm-hmm.
It means you have to have – it means you have to care. You have to have
mm-hmm. –
have or develop this sense of passion, this sense of excitement and fulfillment about – having done something really well, even if it's just, you know, what it is the way that you swept the closet, you know, but you did it really well.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that is so fulfilling. That's one of those little things that determines, you know, that's like make your bed.
Yes, and excellence can be subjective.
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. Yep. Yep.
But as long as you know that you put your best foot forward, that's what really matters.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because, you know, there are lots of authors who have had books out that sold a whole lot more copies than I did. And if my measure of excellence for a book was whether it hit the New York Times bestseller list or whether it sold, you know, 10 million copies or whether it made me into a millionaire, or any of these, those so-called objective measures, they're just like so much dust in the wind. They're so meaningless.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's not to poo-poo numbers because I, you know, when I write a book, my intention is that a lot of people read it. So it matters a lot to me that, you know, I'd much rather sell 100,000 copies of a book than 1,000 because that means 100,000 people got the book. And that's like what I want. That's my goal is to touch people, a lot of people. But yeah, the way that you measure excellence is not necessarily by society's standards.
Mm-hmm. It really is. Why did you come up with the title, The Recipe?
It's funny because it took a long time. Some books, I mean, The Go-Giver, we had the title before we had anything else. And that's, mm-hmm. But The Recipe, we went through many titles, honestly. And it was a book sort of in search of itself. We weren't honestly sure what we were writing at first. Sometimes you don't know what a book is until you're in the middle of writing it and you kind of figure it out, which I think is how most of us live our lives. We're not quite sure what our lives are until we're in the midst of it. I'm 64 years old, and I feel like I've just started kind of figuring out, oh, this is who I am. So this mm-hmm. book was like that. It didn't know what it was. What we realized in the course of writing it was that we were really writing about the boy's journey to sort of finding for himself a roadmap for a meaningful life for himself. And that roadmap became the recipe. And there's a moment in the story, and it's funny, Denise, because this happens, you relate to this. It happens, I think, beginning of chapter two or the end of chapter two. It's very early in the book, but it's a reminiscence. The boy comes home from the diner. He's discouraged, upset, alone. And he has a memory of his dad. Coming into the kitchen and finding his dad there on a Saturday morning. Now, his father's died now, right? He's gone before the book began. But mm-hmm. this is his memory from a few years back. Comes in the kitchen Saturday morning. His father's making his father's famous oat blueberry pancakes. And it's a tradition, a family tradition, that every Saturday morning, the dad makes these famous, wonderful pancakes, and they bring them upstairs to his mom, breakfast in bed. And he goes through this routine of asking his father, you know, what makes the pancakes so delicious? Is it the flour? Is it the maple syrup? Is it the this? Is it that? And finally, his father leans down and says, Owen, the boy's name, Owen, the secret ingredient isn't anything in the pancakes. The secret ingredient is, I get choked up when I say this. The secret ingredient is who you're making them for.
Uh-huh,
and so that's the recipe. That recipe, it is, by the way, the last recipe in the back of the book is that recipe for those pancakes, which is my wife's pancake recipe.
I know.
But it's also on the cover of the book. If you look at the cover of the book, is a picture of those pancakes and that one.
That's right,
rose
with the blueberries.
And a cup of coffee.
Carol,
I'll tell you a secret. That scene wasn't in the first draft of the book. It was something that came in only later when we started really probing and saying, what was Owen's life like with his father? So the recipe, it's the actual recipe and the scene with his dad, it was something that we had to kind of tease to the surface and be patient with. And that became, I think, the heart of the book. It's that recipe. The secret ingredient is who you're
mm-hmm.
doing it for.
Well, it's ironic because, you know, my father's no longer with us, but he used to make us pancakes every Sunday morning and spaghetti every Sunday night.
I love it. Oh,
and so, I have a lot of siblings, and one of my brothers, he just loves spaghetti. And, of course, I'm a champion of pancakes, although I don't eat them very often. So,
yes.
It is. It is.
You got to try
the
oat pancakes, Denise. These are really, really good. These oat pancakes in the in the back of the book. They're special.
Will do.
You know,
I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah. Every morning I bring my wife a cup of, when she's barely awake, she opens her eyes and there I am with a cup of hot tea. It's only tea. It's like a cup of green tea. But I've heard her tell, a dozen friends about how delighted she is every morning. I bring her this cup of hot tea. The tea isn't a big deal. I mean, although she loves that cup of hot tea, and I usually bring a second and a third because we love our hot tea in the morning. But it's that, you made it for me. You made it. I told the story of the recipe once in a radio show, and the host told me that when he was a kid, his dad used to serve them the special water. He would have this way of making the special water that tasted better than any other water. And they still kid him about it. As grown kids, they still go to his house and ask for special water. You know what it was? It was water with ice cubes in it. Like, that's it. But it was their dad put this water in this pitcher, and so it was this special water, and it was like stone soup, it was. It's the human interaction of it is just can be so magical and so powerful.
It really is. Your wife doesn't get a stomach ache from green tea without anything in her tummy.
No, and it's actually some mornings I make it very mild, very for that very reason. I just dip the bag a few times, and boom, there you go. Everybody else, you can just wait. Denise and I are having a conference here about tea. so sometimes I'll make a cup and I say, I know this is too strong. You know, so. Yeah,
because I can't drink it on an empty stomach.
Mm-hmm. I totally understand.
I get the worst stomach ache.
I used to drink coffee first thing in the morning. That's gone. I used to drink black tea in the morning. Love it. Can't do that anymore. Now I drink green tea in the morning. Love it. Yeah, I probably, when I'm 90, I'll drink that guy's, dad's special water or something.
mm-hmm.
Whatever.
Green tea is really, it's really good for you. It really is.
Oh, yeah.
I just can't do it on an empty tummy.
I understand. You need some of Chef Thomas's famous Oat Blueberry pancakes in there first is what it is, I think, probably.
We're going to totally try them. We really will. They better be good, or I'm going to get in trouble.
Yeah, seriously.
But it's the intention, right?
They'll
taste great.
Yeah, well, the intention is certainly a big part of it. Execution, I think, is also, however, valuable. I mean, it's like, everybody these days have seen master chefs on television because cooking shows are so popular. So, most people have seen the most ridiculously, how do they do that? Like superhero kind of superpowers kind of cooking on television. When I hang out with Chef Charles, it's interesting because he is that level. He's won, I think it's eight gold medals at the Olympics. He has been a world Olympian in cooking. He's a world-class chef. He was the president of the World Association of Chef Societies, for the last several years. So the guy is a world-class chef. When I cook in his kitchen, it's not so much dazzled by the fancy knife work or the fancy this or the fancy that. Watching the way he interacts with the ingredients is really special. It's so interesting.
I bet it would be really fun to watch.
Oh, it is so much fun. Now, there's definitely skill there, and there's a lot of sensitivity in the timing of things. A lot of cooking is timing, honestly.
Sure.
A lot of great cooking is patience,
and a lot of
great cooking is timing. But the way that he's kind of babies and coddles and is like intimate with the ingredients, it's almost like watching a potter making something out of clay or watching, someone fingerprint or something. It's really, really, really very cool. So we did do a few videos up on the book's website to show chef cooking. But it doesn't even that.
Oh, okay. And what's that? And tell our listeners what the website is.
Ah, it's from the subtitle of the book. It's theingredientsofgreatness.com.
Oh, wow. That's great. I like that. I really like that.
Yeah, we had fun building that.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to add today? We've covered a lot of territory, that's for sure.
Well, I guess I just want to say that you know, I guess I'll say two things. One is that, as I said, parables have been around obviously since the Bible and you know, going back to the dawn of time, human beings have lived and learned with parables, you know, forever. To me, I love writing parables because I love the power of these simple principles, these simple lessons. But as I said before, earlier, parables got to, if it doesn't move you, then it's not doing its job.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a disguised lecture. And most people don't really care for lectures. So I hope that anyone who does read the book, I hope that the book moves you. I will tell you that if I didn't cry while I was writing it, I know you wouldn't cry while you were reading it. I cried a lot. But it isn't just that it's sad. I mean, it's not fundamentally a sad book. It's a book of triumph and it's a book of joy. There's real tragedy. There's real growth. There's real difficulty. And there's real triumph. And I just hope that people will be uplifted and inspired by the story. And it is in discussion right now. It's probably going to be made as a film. So a film version will be coming out in the years ahead.
Yes, I that was going to be my next question. there was an excellent film that was made, and it took place over in Europe, and I can't remember the name of it. And they really didn't have hardly any characters involved. It was actually, I think, a young guy and the chef and another woman. Gosh, I wish I could remember the name of it. That actress is quite famous, too, who played the lead.
Chef Charles would know.
But your book reminds me. Yes, he would. Yeah, you should ask him, because it was a great movie, very heartwarming. Or was it that they had, maybe I'm starting to recall it, that they had an Indian family that was living across the road from them.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
And it was the Indian kid who, the Indian kid went and learned from the woman chef.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I cannot pull it up for the life of me, but I know exactly what you mean. It's a beautiful
movie.
And there've been a handful.
Yes.
Funny thing is, there've been a handful of these, but not that many. You know, a handful, but not that many.
That's
you know,
true.
There's been.
That's very true.
You know,
true.
Spanglish was about a chef. You know, Adam Sandler was a chef, and you know, there were a bunch of others. But that have been very, very good movies. We aspire to join that group, though, and we've got a wonderful production company with an A-list actor who is very excited about the book, who happens to have an old family connection with Chef Charles up in Vermont, and they are they're in love with the book, and they're working right now with backers to assemble the funds to start shooting. So we've got a committed crew and a committed production company, and I can't tell you when it will be. Will it be in 2019? Maybe, probably 2020 is more likely, but it's coming. It's coming around the bend. I can't wait.
That is that's going to be just great. Can't wait to see it. Can't wait to see it. I think the movie was called The 100-Foot Journey.
Oh, that rings a bell.
It was done in 2004. Yeah. A family, they left India, they went to France, and then they opened their restaurant, and it was right across the street from a four-star eatery.
Well, food is so basic to human existence. I mean, it's always felt to me like the kitchen is the center of the home, and I don't mean that just in a sentimental way, but kind of a functional way. And I do think that in terms of family life, and whether that's just a couple, two people, or a larger family unit, I think that the experience of cooking together, eating together has always been and is such a powerful glue in families. And there's this back farm to table movement now that's so strong in this country and in other countries that I think is such a healthy thing for the world, because with the explosion of fast food restaurants and easy ways of eating out and frozen food and so forth over the last two, three generations, there's almost like a reaction or a response or a pendulum swing going the other way now, of people wanting to experience fresh ingredients, wanting to actually get their fingers in the dirt, wanting mm-hmm. to cook things themselves, be in their kitchens, cook mm-hmm. together, eat together. I think the whole Food Network craze, all the cooking shows, yeah, they're silly in one way, and they're kind of showy in one way, unrealistic entirely in many ways. But I think at heart, they really exhibit and they're an expression of a really healthy impulse, which is, you know, we can tune in on our television sets to watch, you know, police solve a murder, and that's cool. We can watch people have a contest, and that's great. We can watch, you know, a family laugh and cry and have a sitcom, and that's great. But food is like, we want to get educated about how to cook, about how to get back in our kitchens, mm-hmm. feed each other, mm-hmm. feed ourselves. And, you know, your show is normally all about health. And there's nothing more fundamental to health than what we eat and how we eat it. It doesn't Absolutely. Matter whether you're talking about, you know, the most modern of surgical interventions or acupuncture, acupressure, the yellow emperor, Chinese herbs, any kind of medicine, none of it is as fundamental to human experience as the food we put in our mouths every day. And that's the fundamental way that you create your health, is with your food. Mm, so I'm excited nutrition. About I'm excited about this. Yep, yep. From the soil
well, thank
to, the,
you.
To the body.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, John David Mann. It's been really wonderful interviewing you. And
you are so welcome.
Continue on. Can't wait to read your next book.
No worries. I will definitely continue on. It's in the pipeline. It's coming out. You know, I'm blessedly busy putting out book after book after book.
And for the listeners, they can purchase your book, The Recipe. I assume it's on your website, but it's probably on Amazon, everywhere else, correct?
Yeah, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, everywhere, all the book sites, books are there. And also if people want to see what my other titles are, my website is just my name, johndavidmann.com. And all my books are there.
Thank you. Have a wonderful evening. Make some
you
good
too.
Food.
You too. Thank you so much. I will.
Okay.
I will. I'll be thinking of you the next time I eat those pancakes.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Take care, Denise.
You too. All right, that wraps up our show. Please join us again next week. We're going to have another great one for you on Wednesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. We never disappoint. Take care. Bye-bye.
We celebrate our listeners worldwide and invite you to contact Denise at www.healthmedianow.com with any questions you may have, and follow her on Twitter at Health Media Now and Facebook at Health Media Now. For those interested in an advertising campaign on her show, contact Lisa at knowledgeworkspub.com. Be sure to visit gotcancernowwhat.com for information on Denise Messenger's award-winning book, Got Cancer? Now What?